and welcome back to the Over and Back Classic NBA Podcast. I am Jason, and with me as usual is Rich.
Hello. Hello, Rich. How's it going?
Doing well. How about yourself?
Not bad.
Good. Good. Do you feel like, going out there and making some changes?
Breaking some rules? Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm gonna take down the authority, take down the man.
There you go.
If we're nothing if not just rebels and revolutionaries on this podcast. So yeah, no.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't like rules. Rules are stupid.
I appreciate. Yeah, rules are very dumb, and I don't like them.
Unless you
bad
make
rules.
New. If you make new rules, I'm okay with that though.
Yeah. See, I went to a career fair for my daughter recently, and I volunteered for it. And there was a friend of mine who was a lawyer was explaining to the kids the difference between good rules and bad rules, and was writing down examples of what, you know, is a good rule and what is a bad rule. Like, what rules that, like, lead to, like, deporting people are bad rules, and, you know, rules that lead to good behavior are good rules. So, so I say we follow the good rules and ignore the bad ones.
Right, and this country definitely represents that thought process as well. So that's
indeed
good. So
yes.
We don't like deporting people, and we love being good. So that
exactly, good exactly. So, so we are talking about NBA players who have caused rule changes through either their excellence and dominance of the game, or just happening to be in the right place in the right time.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting amount of people that have done this. You know, you'll see a lot of people on this list are guys. A lot of the early rules, and especially those, are big. Like, the guys just dominating the games, guys that are just doing so much that you have to change something. They have to, you know, alter the game a little bit to try to get these people to not dominate quite as much. And of course, you could argue, hey, well, whatever, they're dominating too bad. But you'll see some of these rules are like, it's kind of good that they did add that rule. Like, that is probably a good thing. And we kind of attribute them to these certain players. Not every rule that we're going to mention here is directly attributed to that player, but there are many that are kind of, they came about because of this player. They came about because of influence from this player. And there are going to be ones as well. A lot of the more recent plays are just like silly people being in the right place at the right time. But for the most part, these are kind of the elite players of the league that are mentioned among these of guys that had kind of revolutionized the game by causing rule changes. So you'll see quite a few here. But just do note that a lot of them are, some of them were right place, right time. But like you said, a lot of them were also just like, we are dominant players. You need to change the game because we are just absolutely killing your league. So.
Yeah, absolutely. It is really interesting how many of these are inspired by, there's this dominant big man and we don't know what to do with him, and so we're going to change the, you know, entire scope of the game to work around that. And luckily, you know, most of these rules led to basketball that, you know, that led to improvement in the game. So most of them had good outcomes, but I'm not sure, or even the ones that didn't necessarily have good outcomes, usually they change course pretty quickly anyway.
Right, yeah, the first one we're going to go, 1936, and this was Leroy Edwards, and it was the three-second rule, something we kind of always think of, but wasn't a thing. The three-second rule was implemented in 1936 to prevent big players from controlling area and to prevent rough playing under the board. Leroy Edwards is generally recognized as the player responsible for the implementation of the rule. Edwards was a 6'5 center in the early days of professional basketball. He started in college, and he joined the professional Oshkosh Wisconsin All-Stars in the National Basketball League in 1936. Three-second rule did not prevent Edwards from dominating the game throughout his career. He played professional ball from 1936 to 1949, and is considered one of the all-time best basketball players, but he is not in the Hall of Fame.
Yes, that is a contention of Curtis Harris a lot, Probe's history, that Leroy Edwards is not in the Hall of Fame. Definitely deserves a beat. Yeah, was a dominant star in the NBL, won multiple MVP awards. For those who don't know, the NBL was one of the two leagues that was the predecessor to the NBA that merged together with the BA in 1950, and several teams, including the Lakers and the Hawks and the Royals, all began in the NBL before moving on to the NBA. So important to the roots of the game, and Leroy Edwards definitely one of the, you know, the top elite players during that time. But speaking of elite players, George Mikan, who did a whole lot, of course. The game really was changed a lot because of him in different ways. And the thing that probably is most well known, although happened relatively late in his career, is 24-second clock. And it wasn't just because of Mikan, because there was definitely an issue with there being a lot of stalling at the end of games. games. And there's famously a game that Mikan was involved in. His team lost 19-18 due to, you know, the other team basically stalling the entire way through. So his style led to sort of the introduction of the 24-second shot clock. And the owner of the Syracuse Nationals, Danny Biasone, basically came up with the idea of he thought that, you know, basically each team took 60 shots, and that if you shot every 24 seconds over the course of a 48-minute game, you would get 120 shots. So it was ended up being kind of a stroke of genius. And eventually he came up with the idea in 51 and then spent 3 years selling the other owners on it. And finally, once there were, you know, problems with attendance and feeling like the game was too slow in it, they adopted it before the 55 season, and the rest is history. It obviously revolutionized the game and slowly led to increased popularity, and everyone basically realized it was great for the most part almost immediately.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, but my buddies and I, we tend to watch a lot of Illinois high school basketball. We were really big fans of it, but they don't have a shot clock, and we were at the state finals quite a few years ago. It's almost maybe a decade ago, and there was a team that won like the state championship, where they won like 24-10 or something like that, and they used like four corners, and they once they got up, that was it. They were not going to score, not going to pass, and it was just the worst game I've ever been to. It was so bad. I was like, ah, oh, God, why do we not have a shot clock at least for like the finals or whatever if you can't do it?
But
yeah, it's pretty amazing that there are still leagues that don't have shot clocks, and it's just it stuns me that people don't see the what it can do, because, you know, again, this, you know, adding the 24-second shot clock to the NBA was just incredible. I mean, it eliminated stalling, and it hiked up league scoring by 13.6 points per game. So basically saved the league, too. I mean, in a lot of ways, I mean, the league was just kind of boring and wasn't really doing much. And of course, the NBA, you know, at many times would have these peaks and valleys, but this was a huge part of getting the league, you know, to be something that people actually wanted to pay money to watch, because otherwise it's just really not that fun of a game without, you know, the scoring dynamic in there. So definitely something that's awesome. There's also the Mikan rule. And it's actually dubbed the Mikan rule. The paint widening from 6 inches to 12 inches due to his dominance inside. The first year of the Mikan rule, George Mikan had 23.8 points per game. That was almost 5 points lower than what it had been the previous year. And his field goal percentage dipped to 0.385, and it had been 0.428 the year before. So we see, you know, the combination of Leroy Edwards and the three in the key, including then the Mikan rule, where now the key is a little bit larger there, so that, you know, he can't just park himself down there, and he can't just be, you know, really close to the basket every time. He's kind of have to get away from the basket every so often. So we see kind of our first combination of those two rule changes kind of coming together to work to try to, you know, reduce dominance of certain players, in particular George Mikan.
Yeah, and this is sort of right in the middle of Mikan's period of dominance. It's been 51-52, and you know, the Lakers won. They won 5 championships in 6 years in the NBA. They also won an NBL title the year before then. So, you know, they were kind of on a run of 6 championships in 7 seasons. The only year they didn't win one was when Mikan was injured. So, yeah, I mean, he was definitely the most dominant player of his era, and probably, you know, not really appreciated how just amazing he was during that time, and how, you know, obviously the athletes during that time, it was also still a very white dominated game. There were a handful of black players who were in the league, but it was obviously a different game. It's a completely different population, a completely different thing. And yeah, I can understand in some ways, you know, looking down on the segregated game, but, you know, Mikan was a tremendous player, and really, you know, from all, you know, pretty much everything that's been told, you know, pretty decent person too. And a pretty good ambassador for the sport during a time that was important in its development and in becoming eventually a major league sport in a few years afterward.
Yeah, and a few other George Mikan things. His dominating play around the basket led to the outlaw of defensive goaltending in the NCAA. He also was responsible, of course, you know, mentioned ABA 3-point line, later adopted by the NBA, the existence of the Minnesota Timberwolves, and the multicolored ABA ball, which still lives on today as the, you know, the money ball in the NBA 3-point contest, and is the iconic ball of the ABA, and the kind of, I'd say the iconic image of the ABA. I think after our basketball mysteries in the 1970s, I think we can pretty safely say, I mean, you show somebody that ball, and I think one of the first things they think of is either, is probably the ABA.
Yes,
1970s
absolutely.
Basketball for sure. So,
yeah, I mean, even when I was a kid, like, I understood that it was the ABA ball,
yeah,
even though the ABA had been gone for 10 years or so, you know, by the time I saw it and understood it. So, yeah, that says something.
All right, 1960s, Wilt Chamberlain. You can, again, not a direct result of anything that Wilt did, but pretty much the idea that, hey, Wilt is dominating this league and let's try to figure out something that we can do. And many of these rules you'll see are very Wilt-centric. Lane widening, offensive interference, free throw dunks, and inbounds. Here are the ones, like Mike, in the lane was widened once again from 12 to 16 feet to try to reduce Wilt's presence near the basket. Offensive interference was introduced. It's kind of amazing to think that that wasn't a rule at certain points, but I'm sure Wilt, making many points via that, said, okay, I think we maybe have to change this a little bit and come up with something, but it's just amazing to think that that's not a thing, that a guy could just go up there and just kind of put the ball in the basket. But also shooters could no longer cross the free throw line during free throws. Wilt would routinely throw it against the backboard and then dunk it after free throws, which kind of sucked that they took that away from him, because he kind of was terrible at free throws and it kind of played yes. for the rest of his career. So
right,
that sucks, because I'm sure he made many points doing that, because again, like, just like imagine the NBA if that was an occurrence still today, would just be incredible. I think I want them to get rid of that rule, because I want to see Andre Drummond try that every single time he's up there. Like, I think that'd be just incredible to see. But yeah, pretty awesome that he could do that, and then they said, no, you need to stop doing that. And another last rule, the ball can no longer be inbounded over the backboard. Inbounders would stand underneath the basket and routinely lob the ball over the backboard for Wilt, which is another incredible play that I would love to see happen more often. We do still see inbound, you know, alley-oops, but never like we throw it over the backboard and then he just kind of climbs and dunks. But that's pretty fun as well. So
that would be a lot of fun. Yeah, I didn't realize that one. That was a change. Yeah, and some of these also target Russell as well. I think interference in particular, that, you know, but yeah, we will offensively was just so incredibly dominant that, you know, that they're trying to slow him down. So yeah, that's a pretty good one, obviously. Yeah, and a player in the 70s we talked about before, Daryl Dawkins. And it's most famous, I think, for two things. I think one for his rim shattering dunks and backboard shattering dunks, in fact, and also, of course, his penchant for colorful nicknames. But he wasn't the first player famous for breaking backboards. Gus Johnson of the Baltimore Bullets in the late 60s and early 70s. He shattered three during his career in the NBA, and then also Charlie the Helicopter Hentz, he shattered two backboards in the same game in the ABA in 1970, resulting in the game being canceled. Although I believe, if I remember the story correctly, that they actually finished the game like at 3 a.m. So perhaps there's a different version of the story, or perhaps he
in the ABA. Are you saying that there are two different stories of something in the ABA? I will not believe it. That
I know.
They're not corroborating stories of something that happened in the AVA. I'm shocked by this.
Yes, but I believe, according to Loose Balls, the game was eventually played at like 3 in the morning.
And I think we talked about this in one of our episodes of the Basketball Mysteries. I just love the idea that, like, he breaks one and it probably takes like an hour to put this thing back together, and then he just comes and dunks again. They're like, God damn it, Charlie. Like, it took so long to get that. Like, we're the ABA. We don't have that much money. Like, we can't afford another basket, man. Like,
yeah. And this is Pittsburgh, which was like the worst.
Right.
And,
it's like, do we have like $10?
Had the least money. So,
right,
yeah.
We have no money. Please stop breaking backboards. But, yeah, and then Daryl Dawkins' dunks were so dynamic that they forced the NBA to change the hoop that they use. At the end of the 1979 season, the NBA decided to switch to the newly created breakaway rims that would allow the rim to bend a little bit when too much pressure was applied. So kind of altering the way that the rim, and we know those rims now is kind of, that's what every rim that, you know, any decent backboard you go to, any decent, you know, you go to high school, you go to college, you watch an NBA game, they're all using the breakaway rims. So commonplace now, but then it was kind of the first thing, and the NBA said, well, we need to get these because he keeps breaking our damn backboards. So
yes, and of course, you know, the dunks themselves, the first one with Bill Robazin is, you know, one of the more famous images of its time. It's, you know, it's on YouTube, it's on constant videos. I don't think the second time that he shattered the backboard, I'm not sure that, I don't believe that is actually on video. I could be wrong about that, but I don't recall ever seeing it. I'm not sure if you ever did.
I don't think so. No, I've only seen that first one that you mentioned.
Yeah, so I'm thinking the other one isn't on, but he did it, you know, within a month or so of each other before they basically told him to stop doing it, and then of course changed the rim. There's also a famous story of Dawkins breaking a rim in during a practice that he didn't want to be a part of during the around this time during the league. And there are a couple of different stories about that. One, that Julius Erving encouraged him to do it because he wasn't really in the mood for practice either. And then another that says that he didn't want him to do it, and then he did, and then Dawkins did it anyway.
So. 1990s, the five-second closely guarded rule. And this one is hard to attribute to one particular player, but many people bring up two guys, Mark Jackson and Charles Barkley. And many people do claim that this was a response to Jackson's penchant for backing down opposing point guards in the post for 15 or more seconds at a time. And if you've ever seen Mark Jackson highlights, and I use those terms loosely, you do see him with his back to the basket just kind of bullying up on a guy trying to get any position. And because of that, and in large part because of Mark Jackson, they instituted the five-second rule, and it's sometimes referred to as the Mark Jackson rule. Charles Barkley as well was known for getting it in the post and just kind of putting his big ass to the basket for a long amount of time until he got the guy out of the way and then scored. But a lot of people do attribute it to a little bit more of Mark Jackson. And the rule, if people don't know, is a player in the front court below the free throw line extended is not permitted to dribble the ball with his back or side to the basket for more than 5 seconds. So interesting one there. 1987, we have the Michael Jordan rule. Now, this is a very interesting one that I think a Twitter user brought to our attention. I was not aware of this being kind of attributed directly to him, but it was definitely one that is. At the start of the 1987 season, the NBA created a new rule that prohibits teams from placing three or more players above the top of the key away from the ball, thus clearing out spots for a one-on-one or two-on-two play. A violation would result in loss of possession. Officially, it's called Section 32, Paragraph 15, but around the league, it's getting known, and this is in a Chicago Tribune article, that it's getting known as the Michael Jordan rule in response to Jordan's insane 37.1 scoring average in the 1986-87 season. And just to give you an idea of how dominant Jordan was that season, he had 2 60-point games, 6 50-point games, and 29 40-point games. So that's quite a lot. According to Bulls coach Doug Collins, the Bulls did not specifically have plays to isolate Jordan. He's lying. It's just that his skills enable him to look as if everybody else is standing around and watching. So I don't know what's happening. It's just, you know, he's just doing it. Like, I don't know why my players are all standing around and looking at him. Whatever. Like, all right, Doug, we get it. But
that's, yeah, you know. When it comes to bad lies, that's an all-time, like,
right. No, we don't right isolate there. Michael Jordan? No, are you? No, we don't do that. It just happens. Like, I don't know. I call the play. He doesn't run it, and then whatever, man, geez, scored 60 again, darn. But because of these players seemingly could score almost any time against any single defender, many teams have used them that way. And when teams would try to double on the offensive player, they'd often be caught in a zone defense by leaving another player unguarded, which calls for a technical foul on the second violation. So you couldn't do zone at this time, so it wasn't really a good way to guard these guys if they cleared out. So this was why the rule kind of went there. And this is Rod Thorne, the VP of operations at the time. He said, over the past 4 or 5 years, basically you were seeing a lot of two-man games and three guys with nothing to do. The prevailing opinion was that aesthetically it looked terrible. It's not what basketball is about. There was some discussion about allowing zone defenses, but it was decided to try this and see what happened. And added Jerry Krause, a lot of coaches thought it was ugly to have eight guys standing around watching two play, and in effect, that's what it was at times, which is interesting because both those men have connection to the Bulls, including Rod Thorne, who drafted Jordan, and then Jerry Krause, who had Jordan at the time. But, you know, hey, like, I guess they didn't want him to be as dominant as he was. To be fair, they won a lot more when they post this rule, but I don't know if that was exactly why it was because Jordan.
Yeah, it's not like it got rid of isolation.
No, exactly.
I mean, so, but yeah, it's interesting that they saw this as such a thing. Yeah, I don't remember. I'm not sure if they abandoned that or if, you know, if there were ways in which the, you know, teams were able to kind of get around it. Maybe with some nominal movement that was sort of just kind of faked movement, sort of designed to get around the rule, but still to, you know, set up isolation plays. I'm not sure, but
right,
that,
yeah,
that's
like two guys running baseline, even though they're obviously not in the play and they're not doing anything.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So, Manute Bol's, quote of, the man who made the rule, I want him to be my friend. I don't like the isolations. Sometimes I was so far outside that I thought I'd catch a cold. So,
oh, I love
of course, later on, he'd just shoot three-pointers, so it'd be okay.
Yeah, but, exactly. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Of course, on defense, during the time you had to basically stick with your man on defense, you could rotate on defense, but you couldn't do what they do today and kind of cheat over to somebody else. You had to really be very close to your man, or that was illegal defense.
Yeah,
so that
arm's length
obviously changed the dynamics there.
So,
yeah.
The Bulls center, whatever center that had an isolation player, could just have him parked in, you know, the corner of the 3-point line with no desire to ever catch the ball. It's not like he was a stretch four. It was just get out of the way, and then take your defender out of the way as well, including if it's a Manute Bol or guys that are really good at blocks, just get that guy as far away from me as possible, and then I'm gonna isolate and go to the rim. rim. So yeah, it was a good rule, but like you're saying, it I don't know how strictly it was enforced, because yeah, we saw, of course, the 90s and much of the early 2000s that it, you know, isolation players still dominated the league, and in many cases dominated more than ever. So it didn't really help all that much. And Wilt Chamberlain believed that the rules, they changed the rules to help Jordan dominate, while they changed the rules to prevent Wilt from dominating. If Michael was here right now, I would say to him, when you are so great that the league tries to change the rules and attempt to stop you, then you can claim you are the best ever. Every rule change I've seen during your career has meant to enhance your game, such as shortened three-point line, hat-checking rules, and well-defined rules regarding illegal defenses. So,
although in this case, this rule would go against that.
Right.
I mean, I think Wilt does have a bit of a point that there were a lot of rules. I'm not saying that they were designed to help Michael, but they certainly, Jordan benefited from them. But I do think in this case, obviously, that Jordan was still pretty dominant. It didn't really prevent him, but he never scored 37 points a game again. So, although it probably, some of that I think maybe just have been some changes in the way that the Bulls did things to get other players involved, and they would have better players involved quickly enough.
Without Doug Collins.
I mean, even with Doug, but yeah, especially after Doug was gone with Phil Jackson, yes.
Absolutely. 1990, the Trent Tucker rule. This is our first rule of a guy that's like, huh, who the hell's Trent Tucker? The Trent Tucker rule was born out of a game between the Knicks and the Chicago Bulls on January 15th, 1990. The game was tied at 106 with 0.1 seconds left in regulation and the Knicks in possession. During a timeout called by the Knicks, both teams prepared for what was seen as the only possible way the Knicks could win in regulation, an alley-oop tap-in from out of bounds by Patrick Ewing. When play resumed, the Knicks players throwing the ball in, Mark Jackson, the aforementioned Mark Jackson, saw the alley-oop play get broken up. He then proceeded to throw the ball inbounds to Tucker, who was the only player open. Tucker then turned around and hit a three-point jump shot before the buzzer, giving the Knicks the win 109-106. Replay showed that the clock was not started until Tucker's shot was already in midair. The Bulls, led by first-year head coach Phil Jackson, later filed an official protest with the NBA about the play. By their estimate, the play took closer to 0.4 seconds. However, the timekeeper, Bob Billings, and referee Ronnie Nunn, who were working the game, claimed everything went perfectly fine. If you watch the video, it's obvious that the clock does not start until like it's in, and again, like I won't get into the gritty details here, but you can look it up if you want. But there were a lot of like scoreboard thing, like people got really deep into this role where people looked at like different scoreboard manufacturers and delay of like when you press a button and when the thing starts or whatever. So it's a whole mess. If you want to get into that, you can read up it. Just look up the Trent Tucker rule and you'll find that out. But anyway, Vice President of Operations Rod Thorne, again, was the only NBA executive to side with the Bulls. Incidentally, Thorne was once the general manager of the Chicago Bulls, as we mentioned above, so it's kind of funny again. Thorne argued that it was physically impossible for a player to receive an inbounds pass and release it for a shot in less than a tenth of a second. He pointed out that tests in European basketball games, which had counted down to the final minute of a period in tenths of seconds, proved that a catch and shoot takes at least 0.3 seconds. So the NBA commissioner David Stern made it a requirement that all NBA arenas have their official game clocks properly calibrated in the wake of the incident, resulting in massive scoreboard overhauls in almost all arenas. And I said again, you can look that up if you want, in kind of the gory details of scoreboard tech. But the official rule now reads that no less than 0.3 must expire on the game clock and shot clock when a ball is thrown inbounds and then hit instantly out of bounds. If less than 0.3 expires in such a situation, the timer will be instructed, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, you need at least 0.3 on the clock before you can take a shot. But yeah, this was the last rule, and it is known as the Trent Tucker rule. So very interesting.
There you go. Yeah, and I like Phil Jackson's point where, you know, that there were some arenas that were notorious for the clock holding at 0.1 seconds before the horn sounded. And then he said, as a player for the Knicks in the 70s, he noted that the clock there tended to run slower when they were behind and faster when they were ahead. The Celtics, of course, notorious for that. I'm sure the other arenas as well. You know, when you have a home clock operator who works for the arena and is, you know, biased toward the home team, you're going to get stuff like that. So obviously that was a needed rule and makes sense. Yeah. And so, yeah, the only types of field goals allowed at 0.2 or 0.1 are a tip-in or a high lob. So, and we've seen a few of those be game winners here and there. It's obviously pretty rare, but that does happen on occasion.
Absolutely. I think earlier this year, Marc Gasol did one, right?
That's right. Yes. Good point. So, Shaquille O'Neal has been has generated a couple of rules changes. One, early in his career, after the 1992-93 season, they increased the steel brace strength and increased stability of the backboard to prevent the hoop from falling down after Shaq broke it twice in the previous season. The glass remained intact, but the Welts in the goal standard failed. So, and they also introduced technical foul for players who destroyed the basket. So, preventing him from doing so again. But there's you can easily find the video of him breaking the hoop and causing delays in games, much like Daryl Dawkins did before, but even in a perhaps more dramatic fashion, although not quite the shattering glass effect that the Daryl Dawkins video has.
Yeah, I do like the Shaq one too, where the basket just like rips apart. And
I mean,
just,
yeah,
like, falls
it's
down
impressive.
And it's just,
yes.
like horrible safety hazard for everybody involved. So,
yeah,
it's pretty good.
Yeah. It's amazing.
There's also the Hack-A-Shaq as well. But,
yes.
Yeah, I don't know. Like, again, we haven't seen, like, there's kind of, like, they don't want to go full on and, like, changing the rules a little bit. But it'll be interesting to see if in the next few years they have kind of went that way a little bit more and more of trying to figure out ways to reduce it. And I do wonder, because we all know it as the Hack-A-Shaq. Like, you know, there are the, you know, the horrible, like, Hack-A-Dwights and people. But, no, it's Hack-A-Shaq because Shaq and Shaq rhyme or whatever. So that's, I feel like when they do make the rule, they kind of have to call it the Hack-A-Shaq rule, right? Like if and when they do come up with something that's, like, a unilateral, like, okay, you cannot do this, or there's got to be something different about doing it, I think they're going to have to call it the Hack-A-Shaq rule, right? So I think we should keep this in place for whenever it does happen. But we have seen many of the rules alter a little bit for those free throws and you know, when you can foul guys, how you foul them, all that
yeah,
sort of stuff. So.
Right, intentional fouls, yeah. I'm all for getting rid of it entirely, but I guess I feel like it has not happened significantly yet so far this season. I could be wrong about that, but I feel like we have not had a whole lot of instances of happening, so perhaps just limiting it in that respect will save us. But so this is an interesting one, and sort of a long evolution where the with zone defense, the NBA had outlawed zone defense from back in the BAA days from in 1947, and then stayed that way until the 2002 regular season. You know, it's interesting talking about in the Jordan rule from 87 ahead of time, how they had kind of considered zone as a way to kind of prevent isolation heavy play. And then finally, you know, 15 years later or so, they finally decide, okay, I guess we're going to go with zone.
Yeah, absolutely. It was an interesting case. And this was Stu Jackson, who was a part of the NBA's management team at the time. And he said the illegal defense guidelines need to be eliminated because they've become problematic. Problematic for our fans who don't understand the rule. Problematic for officials who admittedly have had difficulty administering the rule. And finally, our teams have used the guidelines in a way that produces isolation basketball. So he specifically says isolation basketball. So this one's hard to really attribute to one guy. But you can look at the time period of when this sort of happened. Allen Iverson's obviously a huge one. But also guys like Shaq. And, you know, this is a post-Michael Jordan league as well, where a lot of teams, you know, thought that that was the way to play basketball. You get your best player, you give him the ball and you let him kind of isolate and dribble around. And yeah, that worked for some guys. Doesn't always work for everybody, but either way, it led to very, you know, not very fun basketball. And people can bring up, you know, the 90s of how great watched a lot of late 90s, but it's boring as hell, especially early 90s basketball. It's not very fun. I'll take this basketball any day where guys are passing and moving around and doing all this sort of stuff. So it was definitely in reference to that. And then they also added a 3-second rule this time, a defensive 3-second rule. And Stu Jackson again said, when we eliminated the legal defense guidelines, the number one concern was teams would take bigger players like a Shaquille O'Neal, Theo Ratliff, Sean Bradley, or Dikembe Mutombo and simply put them in the middle of the lane to camp out and prohibit drives to the basket and encourage low percentage shots. In an effort to help alleviate this concern, the defensive 3-second violation was recommended. So they added that on a year later or so, or quite a little bit after that, because they realized, oh shit, like those guys could just park down there and that's not a problem. But then they added that. And then I think we're pretty good now. I kind of like the way that defense is played in the NBA now, and I think there's a little bit more skill involved in kind of playing spots, and you don't see teams running like 2-3 zones or any of these like box and ones. You don't see a whole lot of that, but it allows guys to kind of play off their player a little bit and play lanes a little bit more. And you know, famously LeBron James, especially in his Miami Heat tenure, would kind of play in the middle of the safety and would kind of guard whoever needed to get guarded and kind of influence the play that way. I like it that way. I don't know what you feel.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I mean, it's allowed defense to get more complex, and it rewards more intelligence and versatility and speed and, you know, those type of things and quick hands and that kind of stuff. You know, and you can't really – it's much harder to hide a bad defender than it used to be as well. So I think it's – you know, I think the more that we encourage movement, the more that we encourage skill, the more that we encourage intelligence, I think it makes for a better game. And I think the game has evolved in a, you know, it's not a perfect game now, but it's definitely, I think it's much more watchable than a lot of the late 90s, early 2000s are. Right? There's some good stuff in the late 90s, early 2000s. I don't want to disparage
it
completely.
But, I love that era.
But it's definitely... Yeah.
It's acquired taste. Yeah. When you watch it, like, go watch on the, you know, the Harvard Classics or whatever. Go watch it. It's like, it's a whole different league. Like, you have to kind of be like, oh, okay, yeah, right. Yeah. This is what I'm going to watch now for the next hour. Like,
yeah, the giant baggy uniforms don't help you.
No,
I feel
God,
like
that hurts a lot, yeah. And Bill Walton on commentary. That helps for me, though, but...
okay, well, depending on your point of view.
Exactly. Snapper Jackson... Who am I thinking of? Snapper Jones. Yeah, he's on a lot of those games too, like the late 90s.
Oh yeah, good old Steve Snapper Jones. Yeah. Yes.
And then unfortunately you have Isaiah Thomas also on commentary, which is
yeah.
There was one game I watched and it was like there was two games back to back, and I watched one of them was Isaiah on commentary, which is awful, and then there was Magic on commentary, which was equally bad. Yeah, Magic was really terrible at commentary.
I feel like Magic was worse.
Because he kind of giggled the entire time. It was like Magic Johnson. It was like if you gave Magic Johnson a microphone, like what do you think Magic's gonna do like half the time? And it's just like he kind of was just like smirking. You could tell he was kind of laughing or whatever. Yeah, Isaiah was pretty terrible. I mean, Isaiah's on NBA TV now, and he's not horrible, but, you know, Magic was pretty terrible. what's worse, his late-night show or his commentary or his coaching?
I would imagine the late-night show would probably be the worst, okay, but there you go. It's weird because a lot of people talk about, and obviously, like, Magic Johnson was a genius basketball player, so you would think that he would be able to talk about the game in an interesting way, but for whatever reason, he just doesn't have the ability to convey that, or he just thinks that saying platitudes are what you're supposed to do as a commentator. I don't know.
Yeah,
it's
an ex-player problem. I mean, it doesn't happen as much with the NBA.
Yeah.
Like, it's pretty good. I mean, you watch football games, and it's just like ex-NFL players being like, yeah, gotta try harder, you know what I mean? Like, that sort of stuff. But, like, the NBA, I think, does a pretty good job, but there are still those guys that you kind of – that have those
rubber. There are some, yeah. There are some really good ones, too, you know. But, yeah, Reggie Miller, not so good. John Barry, not so good. But, yeah, a lot of – Brent Berry's great. You know, Chris Webber's pretty good.
Webber's
like
getting a lot better.
You know?
I noticed that earlier this year. I'm like, you know what? Webber's actually pretty good because he was pretty terrible in the beginning, and I think he was nervous to kind of – get too much into the X's and O's and get too much into that. But like the NBA, people love that. I mean, you're not going to really bore a lot of people by giving your expertise on, you know, basketball. So go for it, do it. But yeah, he's definitely gotten better. Exactly. 2004, Vince Carter. This is a rule that he had. It's not really dubbed the Vince Carter rule, but it is in direct relation to him. In 2004, the NBA informed Toronto Raptors star that he could no longer listen to music on his iPod during the 20-minute warm-up period before each game. Carter recently started listening to the music on his headphones, uses his hip new iPod, and that was a violation of the league's rules on proper attire. So they told him no more headbuds and no more iPod. So.
Yes. So, when earbuds were a new thing.
Yeah, you know, exactly. That's been revolutionary. Yeah. There with his sweet iPod and his earbuds.
12 years ago,
It's just amazing. Because when you read it, they're like, on his new Apple iPod, you're just like, oh, yeah, like that was like not a thing for.
I bet he could fit a whole 100 songs on it.
He had the shuffle, though, so I don't know how.
Oh, okay.
I don't know which one. The iPod shuffle is just a weird, like, add music to it. We'll just play whatever we want. Like, why would I want that? Yes.
So here's a fun one from 2010. No upside down logo headbands. The NBA made a move to outlaw them after Rajon Rondo famously wore his headband with the iconic NBA logo upside down. Kelly Dwyer at Ball Don't Lie wrote that in the 90s, when headbands were starting to come back into vogue after a 20-year or so absence, the NBA decided to cash in and replace all the team-issued headbands they provided free of charge to their players with a version that featured the famous NBA logo on top of the team colors, and you had to wear the logoed version for fear of a fine. Rashid decided to turn his headband inside out, but the league came down on that, so eventually he stopped. And then Rondo stopped wearing headbands altogether for a while and then returned to wearing them with no logo presence. And then this year he was the first player since Ben Wallace to wear a headband in game for the Chicago Bulls. In fact, the Bulls have long had a rule which Ben Wallace violated about wearing headbands, which is a very Bulls thing to do.
Dumb rule, it's so stupid. And it was like the beginning of the end of the Ben Wallace and the Bulls era thing. But like,
he
came out and Skiles was pissed and the Bulls were nuts, and I was like, oh god, like, who cares?
It's like the Yankees and it's like that Simpsons episode with all the baseball players and Don Mattingly. It shaves his sideburns, and they don't know what the sideburns are. Eventually, like, shaves half of his head. So, you know, it's good.
I told you to share those sideburns. That's great. My favorite Simpsons episode ever. But
it's pretty good.
Caron Butler, 2010. No straw chewing during games. This is just a bizarre rule that I could not fathom happening. But one of the more bizarre rule changes came in the NBA in 2010 when an NBA official, the aforementioned Stu Jackson, contacted then Dallas Mavericks forward Caron Butler, informing him that he was no longer able to chew straws during games. No longer able to chew straws during games. And this is from ESPN.com. NBA executive president Stu Jackson phoned Butler on Tuesday and told him to leave his straws at home. Butler did not play against the Los Angeles Lakers due to a reaction to medication, so he was unable for comment, but the Mavs confirmed that the league is serious about outlawing straw chewing. A local radio show talk host encouraged fans to come to Wednesday night game against the Lakers bearing straws to show their support for Caron Butler. And then they come into detail here. The habit is not new to Butler, who reportedly had chewed plastic straws at a rate of 12 per game for years. He disclosed in a chat on NBA.com in March 2009 that he started chewing straws in games as a teenager. Very, very strange here. And this would not be the first interesting habit that Butler had to kick. In the summer of 2009, Butler blogged on NBA.com that he had lost 11 pounds just by giving up his daily addiction of drinking at least 6 12-ounce bottles of Mountain Dew. I was going through withdrawals, Butler said on NBA.com. Honestly, those first 2 weeks without the Dew were the roughest 2 weeks of my life. I'm talking headaches, sweats, and everything. Butler said he used to drink the caffeinated soda before Wizards practice and would knock back 2 before games. I like that Caron Butler is 11-year-old me, because I had the exact same addiction as I was a fat 11-year-old. I like how you call it the Dew, too. That's pretty sick.
Yeah, the Dew. Yes, but you don't want to go without the Dew, that's for sure. Yeah, the straw chewing is interesting. I don't know if I have anything to add about that, but the fact that I didn't realize it was 12 per game, you know, for
that's a lot of straws, man. Like,
I kind of forgotten that they'd asked him to stop, and he didn't mean he was around for a number of years. I don't know. This was around the time we stopped kind of being a star player, but you know, I don't know if like that was like Samson cutting his hair, if like not being able to chew the straws like took away his basketball powers and he only became an okay player. But anyway, certainly wasn't the dude that was doing it, but yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. And if you look up player, if you do want to look it up, if you look up Caron Butler straws, you will see many, many pictures of him, including he had like they weren't always like sometimes they are like a big straw, which seems like very dangerous, but sometimes they were just like a little piece of a straw that he would just kind of put in his mouth and chew on or whatever. So that I don't know if I necessarily care all that much. I mean, yeah, sure, it's a choking hazard or whatever, but like there are times when you see him on the court with like a big straw and you're like, all right, that maybe not be the best idea.
Right. So. I wonder if they'll make Steph Curry stop chewing on his mouthpiece eventually.
Yeah, that really annoys my wife. Like every time I watch a game, she's like, "What is he doing? Why is he doing that?" It's going on. Like, I don't know.
Well, it does seem. I mean, you know, I can see the health concerns that she might have. You know, but being the nurse and all, but,
yeah, she does feel disgusting too. So that's.
Yeah, exactly. So the Reggie Miller rule, which came 89 months after he had played his last NBA game in 2012.
They did call it the Reggie Miller rule, though, so we're not making that up. They called it the Reggie Miller rule.
So getting rid of offensive player leg kicks. So a shooter who kicks his legs out during jump shot attempts to create contact and draw fouls. Officials plan to call offensive fouls on shooters who blatantly kick out their legs to initiate contact. I don't know if that really was – sometimes they'll come up with these new rules or new interpretation of rules, and sometimes they'll stick with it, and a lot of times they'll just, you know, enforce it for a month and then kind of forget about it. So I honestly have not paid close attention to how much leg kicking there is going on. I can't say that I've seen it blatantly happen, but I can't, you know, I haven't necessarily noticed the absence of it either, although it's hard to notice the absence of something.
Yeah, exactly. I saw it like just a few days ago. I saw Gordon Hayward do it, and I saw Dwayne Wade does it all the time. Like, yeah, it's a very weird thing. They enforce it sometimes. It's the same thing with that one rule. I mean, I remember a few years ago the head fake and then drive your body into the guy rule. They were big about that for like a year, and then like I just saw it the other day happen again, like multiple times.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, well.
And of course Draymond doing the weird, like, you know, kicking his leg out and, you know, kicking people in the nuts. Yeah, right. Or even when he's not, even just sometimes when there's nobody there, he'll just kick his leg out weird. He does have that weird, it's similar to that, but it's not exactly, because he doesn't always do it with somebody right there. He just does it sort of randomly. It's just some sort of quirk that he has. So, yeah, I guess now I think about it, I do see it here and there. Mm-hmm. But last one, LaMarcus Aldridge, late game goaltending reviews.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. This is this came about. Blazers forward LaMarcus Aldridge was called for goaltending a Kevin Durant shot by referee Scott Foster. This is 2012-2013 season, by the way. A call that helped push the game to overtime, where the Oklahoma City Thunder wound up defeating the Blazers. The next day, the NBA admitted that Foster's call was incorrect. Foster, of course, later apologized. At the start of the 2012-2013 season, the NBA announced a number of reviewable calls, including calls for reviews of goaltending in the final 2 minutes of the game, and all flagrant fouls were reviewed to assess their classification. But yeah, this was in direct result of this play, and they couldn't review it. This was a time when they could review some things, and now we know it is like commonplace that everything, you know, everything gets reviewed like way too long and for 45 minutes each time. But this was a time when they couldn't review that. So there was, you know, the Blazers are going, oh my God, like, no, I didn't, you know, LaMarcus Aldridge is looking at it. You could see it on the replays. Everybody could see it. Everybody knew that it was a bad call, but they couldn't review it. They couldn't change it. Whereas now, and because of that, as a result, you know, 2012-13 season, they added that among a bunch of other things to the reviewable calls. But this is kind of attributed to LaMarcus Aldridge as well, because his was the famous one that was very blatant that he did not goaltend, but they still called it because they didn't have a chance to review it or take it back. And it led to, you know, the Blazers, I believe, losing in overtime of that game as well. So,
yeah. If you could, would you just get rid of review and just...
I would, yeah. I've kind of been that way for a while. I want every call to be right. And, like, I like the idea that, like, calls are right. And I don't like, you know, if my team was getting screwed by a bad call, I would hate that. But, like, watching the games, and I think that same way with the NFL. Like, I don't watch football anymore. And a lot of it is because every single play gets reviewed. Every little second is, oh, let's go. I don't want to watch, like, and baseball, it's getting really bad, too. I don't want to watch a bunch of, like, referees huddling over, a TV screen for 10 minutes or whatever. And they just take so long. If there was something real quick where there's a guy in the home office and he goes, yeah, good, yeah, bad, or whatever. Like, you know, you got 10 seconds to kind of go, okay, I looked at it. Yeah, it's good. All right, you're good. Like, you know, it's something like clarification calls. I'm fine with that. But the idea of, like, these guys standing around and sitting there for 10 minutes just bores the hell out of me. And I really dislike it, so.
Yeah, and yeah, I don't care for it either. They've been trying to get at least to go some of the calls faster, and they've actually done a fairly good job of doing that. But yeah, I would. It does take away from being able to enjoy something in the moment sometimes with the fear that it could get reversed, like a last second shot. You know, you can't necessarily celebrate the last second shot right away. You know, even, you know, if it's made, if it's even close, you know, because you got to do the review and, you know, make sure that it left his hand and all that. It just kind of takes away from the joy of the, you know, the unbridled joy of that moment with having the thought in your head of, oh, maybe that didn't make it in time.
Right, yeah,
you know,
that's
so
good. Yeah, that's a really good point.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, they're never getting rid of it, so and I understand that. And I understand wanting to get it right, and I understand, you know, using some technology to do that. But I do feel like I do think keeping those moments kind of pure and keeping those moments exciting and, you know, and not just having the slow and disruption of the game, I think is more important to me than getting it right.
Yeah,
all the time, just because, you know, it's impossible standard. And one thing I do like about, and a lot of people don't like the last 2-minute reports that they've been doing the last couple of years, but I actually do like them because I do think it just kind of, it sort of demonstrates just how hard it is to get these calls right and how, you know, just I think the transparency and if like people can more understand that like, hey, these referees are, you know, have a hard job and didn't really do the best they can and they're going to get things wrong. But, you know, that's just part of life. It's a game. It's not life or death. Then I think like, you know, I think that's maybe a better attitude. But I feel like the response to them ends up kind of being hyperbolic and ends up like being kind of crazy, and you know, it probably goes against what it's meant to do. But I do think like if you take them kind of in the spirit that they are and just sort of realize like, you know, it's, yeah, referees just sometimes screw up just like everybody else. I think, you know, I think they can be helpful taken in that way.
Yeah, certainly. I 100% agree with you.
Well, there you go. That's nice when we 100% agree. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks everyone for checking us out. You can find us at The Step Back at fansider.com and check out all the podcasts and writing and good stuff there. I'm sure you'll find something that you love. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcast. Just search for Over and Back or search for The Step Back for the entire Step Back feed. And also you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. So thanks for listening, and I'll be back again soon.